This WBEZ podcast is supported by the Crown Family School of Social Work, Policy, and Practice at the University of Chicago. The master's program in social work offers a one-year advanced standing option for students with a bachelor's degree in social work that builds on prior training and connects students with expert faculty and five specialized pathways. Apply by February 1st at crownschool.uchicago.edu/socialwork. Inspire change. Shape the future. WBEZ's Nonprofit Spotlight is supported by UChicago Medicine, providing expert primary and urgent care with locations throughout Chicagoland. Their walk-in urgent care locations offer a variety of services for adults and kids 7 days a week. No appointment needed. And for the visits that can wait a day or two, flexible hours and online scheduling make it possible to find a primary care provider partner. Learn more at uchicagomedicine.org.
Hey, Chicago, I'm Sasha Ann Simons, and this is In the Loop. Later on in the podcast, we'll run through the day's top local stories, from a boost in available buses for CTA riders to a CPD detective who's accused of putting a gang hit out on another detective. We'll break down those stories and much more. But first, Chicago's cultural institutions are known for their art, their science, their history. But behind the scenes, something else has been taking shape. Workers are unionizing.
The folks who work at these institutions can feel invisible.
More museum workers are joining a union, this time at the Adler Planetarium.
Thank you to the Cook County Forest Preserve commissioners and everyone else who stands here today in support of our unionization movement.
Workers at the Griffin Museum of Science and Industry say they have approved their first ever union labor contract.
Today's resolution is about standing with workers across Cook County in museums, not-for-profits, cultural institutions who are courageously raising their voices and asking for a seat at the table.
Since 2020, more than 2,500 cultural workers across Illinois at places like the Art Institute, the Field Museum, and the MSI have organized for better pay and benefits and respect on the job. And even more museum employees are joining that movement. Museums say budgets are tight, but the workers say, well, they've been overlooked for far too long. So this conversation, we dig into what's driving this moment and what it means for Chicago's cultural future. At the table was Anders Lindahl, who's director of public affairs with AFSCME Council 31, Lilias Meyer, who works at the Adler Planetarium and used to work at the Field Museum, and also with us was Sun-Times arts reporter Erica Thompson. Erica kicked things off with just what's behind the recent surge in unionizing efforts. Here she is.
Yeah, so speaking to union leaders like Anders and workers and labor experts, workers want to feel protected. And we've really started to see this since the pandemic. Workers were furloughed, their pay was cut, they were laid off, even as these organizations were getting donations to help them stay afloat. And the workers have said that they didn't notice the high-level executives being impacted in the same way. So they wanted to stand up and advocate for themselves. Mm-hmm. And then now, with the way the economy is going with inflation, workers are also looking for more protection to just be able to live and work in the city.
Yeah, because when you think about it, you know, I think we were adding it up yesterday. These institutions are old, like really old, a century old, some a little bit more, a little bit less. So the question begs, you know, why now? It's been so long.
Yeah, it's really a result of the pandemic and just that frustration that mm-hmm. happened since then. And what we've heard from workers is, you know, these are prestigious jobs, so they've been willing to stay in them because it's nice to say you work in this niche job for this world-class institution, but workers are not able to make a living and get survive anymore.
Yeah, Anders, you had a really good quote in Erica's story on that same note where you talked about, you know, a lot of times they think, you know, we're really lucky to be here, right? Say more on that.
Yeah, I mean, this is something that we heard from the very beginning in 2020, 2021, mm-hmm. when our AFSCME Cultural Workers United campaign, which is a national campaign to help raise up workers in the cultural sector, was really getting going. And workers were saying that, you know, for so long we've been told you're lucky to work here. This is a prestigious institution. You're fortunate to be in proximity to our collection. and our name. And workers were saying, you can't eat prestige. We can't eat prestige. That doesn't keep the, doesn't turn the lights on. It doesn't pay the bills. Mm. And, you know, I think the other motivating factor here is that this is a movement moment, that this is a relatively small world mm-hmm. within the city of Chicago, where, like Lilias, folks move between the institutions and they see what's happening at the other institutions, and it makes it real for them. Mm. It's not like the labor movement is theoretical for them. Forming their union to win a voice and make real gains is very real, and they've seen their counterparts at other institutions do it.
Lilias, I want to get into your story because it is interesting. A year ago today, you were working at the field, right?
Yeah.
You were working at the field. You were part of organizing efforts there. Now you're at the Adler doing the same. Tell us more about what made you start organizing.
Yeah, I've worked in the museum industry my entire career. So I started in a really small museum setting, kind of did what you're supposed to do in museums. I worked my way up. I started doing volunteer work. I started with unpaid labor, which is kind of how you get your foot in the door, right? And it's kind of what you are told in college and in the museum space is, in order to get your foot in the door, you got to do it for free. And then I worked my way up. I moved around to a couple of different museums, and then I actually moved across the country for my job at the Field Museum. So it was the dream job. It was this prestigious institution that I was really excited about. But like Anders is saying, like it's hard to make rent.
And is that what you were hearing from your colleagues?
Yeah, absolutely. I learned a lot through the organizing effort. And the reason I joined was not just for myself either. I had coworkers who were getting paid significantly less than me, who had medical bills, who had families, had children to care for. And they weren't able to make those things happen. Mm-hmm. And they're working at this prestigious institution that, you know, has incredible collections and has incredible access to things around the world, research. And all of these employees are passionate about what they do and they want to stay.
But they're wondering, you know, how dare I speak up?
Right.
Right?
Yeah.
Just in case. So, Erica, you know, I know you talked to a ton of people for your reporting, a ton of other workers. Did what they had to say to you sound pretty similar to what you're hearing right now from Lilias?
Absolutely. Workers at the Chicago Botanic Garden are currently organizing, trying to unionize. Mm-hmm. And I heard from one worker, she got a promotion and she said her raise was only 19 cents. And also, in addition to pay and benefits, workers want to feel safe on the job. So if they're outside working in the garden and the air quality is poor, mm-hmm. what is the process to make sure that we're protected? So those are some of the things that we've been hearing.
Yeah, and I mean, Anders, every group of workers sort of has their own circumstances, right, and their own demands. But would you say that there has been a through line or some common themes?
Oh, absolutely. And I think wages
a significant
seems high
on one. The list. Because, I mean, 19 cents, like Erica just talked about.
Well, or if you look at Museum of Science and Industry, where the AFSCME local union there just ratified their first contract. Mm-hmm. And it took a strike threat in order to get the employer to ultimately move.
Really?
As far as we needed for an agreement. They had not had an across-the-board pay increase at MSI in 3 years, since 2022. MSI was paying a significant share of their workers the city mandated minimum wage. And people were only getting an increase when the city minimum wage was increased. You don't get credit as an employer for giving people an increase because the law says you have to. Now we won a contract that raises everybody's wages immediately by 8 to 10% mm-hmm. and then locks in annual increases going forward. So they're very real, specific wins, but also it's about respect. It's about a seat at the table, a say in the decisions that affect your life at work. And after all, it's folks on the front lines like Lilias who do the real work of these institutions. They're the face of these institutions to the public. These institutions could not function without that work. So workers should be heard.
We talk about workers and you mentioned the front lines. Help us understand more about what museum workers do. What are some of the jobs that you represent?
You know, it's everything from the folks who sell tickets and give tours, who escort school groups, who go out into the community, into our schools and work with teachers and develop curricula. It's the folks who preserve and restore the artworks or the collection of objects, like at the Field Museum. It's folks who design and install the exhibitions. Mm-hmm. It's folks in development, in communications, the back office work. And it's also folks who, you know, care for whether it's the animals at the shed or whether it's all of the priceless weather works of art, like at the MCA mm-hmm. and elsewhere.
You know, workers at the Art Institute, they seem to be what I'd say ahead of the game when they ratified their contract back in 2023. How did that influence what you all ended up doing at the Field and now at the Adler? What were the conversations like? Were you looking like, hey, did you hear what happened over there?
Yeah, absolutely. It was huge. I mean, I think that's the most important thing to come out of this wave, as we're calling it, this momentum. Mm-hmm. We didn't have to start from scratch at the Field. Obviously, it was a ton of work to write a contract and come up with something that was specific and benefited us at the Field Museum specifically. But we could look to our colleagues at the Art Institute for advice on what does it look like to go into bargaining? Mm-hmm. What is this process? For a lot of us, this is the first time we've even been in any unions.
So there's been a solidarity even between the unions.
Absolutely. I mean, I know so many colleagues who stepped over to the Shedd Aquarium to help them at their rallies. I've been to multiple Chicago History Museum rallies. It's become a network of solidarity across the city, and we're hoping that each contract will just get better so that we can uplift Chicago museums as a whole instead of just individual ones.
Yeah. Erica, what does all this mean for the museums themselves? Is there a reason now for like a forced change in their business model? What happens on their end?
Well, they're already reevaluating their business models because they are facing economic challenges right now. So what we've heard is that they are rethinking their membership programs. They're thinking about expanding facility rentals, trying to lower their utility bills, strengthen relationships with city officials for funding. So this is something that they're already doing. So this is kind of just a part of their process.
So overall, financially, not too good, right? Because you report, you know, lost grants and, you know, an overall decline in visitors?
Yes, we've seen a lot of museums report loss of federal grants under this new Trump administration. Also decreased attendance after the pandemic. Some of them saw a boost, but it has fallen back again. So they are struggling as well.
Yeah. Could you feel that on the ground, like while you were working, that decreased attendance, for instance?
Yeah, definitely. I know a lot of my colleagues know this better who work the front lines and who are selling the tickets, and they feel that kind of impact. Yeah. But I also think those people are the ones who we need to be talking to for advice on their opinions. They're the ones that see this work every day. They're the ones that interact with guests every day. So more so than ever, I think unionizing is important. We need those people to have voices at the table.
The frontline staff.
Yeah. They know that work best, and we need to be asking them.
Anders, how do you think this overall push to unionize impacts the visitor experience?
I think it can only be a good thing.
Are there programming changes that they can maybe expect? Tell me more.
Yeah, I think that, you know, Lilius really put her finger on the employees do this work because they love it, out of dedication and commitment to these institutions and their visions. And by organizing, they're doing so out of love to make these places that are so great to visit and to learn also be great places to work. Mm-hmm. And when they are, you're going to see better employee retention so that these dedicated and committed workers are also experienced and skilled and rewarded for that over time.
Right.
And when you have adequate staff, when you retain staff who have that experience, then you have more continuity and you have better programming.
Right. And how nice is that if, you know, as a visitor, especially if you're a frequent visitor to go in and see some of the same faces, right? Because the workers are staying.
Oh, of course. And, you know, Erica talks about the cuts from the Trump administration. As these threats are coming down, we can only benefit from unity, both within the institution, across the cultural sector, and frankly, between labor and management as well.
Yeah.
The fact that Trump tried to shut down the IMLS that provides funding for museums and libraries nationwide, our union AFSCME on a national basis joined together with the American Library Association, the employer group for public libraries coast to coast, and we filed a lawsuit that was very significant in preventing Trump from slashing IMLS funding.
Yeah. And now about those Institute grants of Museum and Library Services.
And now those grants have been restored.
Yeah. So I got to ask, because what we just outlined, you know, and what Erica just sort of described, museums have been struggling, right? They're struggling to fill empty roles. They're seeing that decline in traffic that we talked about. They're losing grants. These are big concerns. And leaders are saying that, you know, higher wages, you want higher wages right now and more benefits. That's just a cost I can't bear. Your response, Lilias.
I mean, through collective bargaining and being at that table, we talked through all of the ways that they could cut back to make sure that people can earn a living wage. I don't think it's ever about not having the money. I think it's about allocating the money to the right places. So I think it's really an excuse to say that they don't have the money. Mm-hmm. I think it's just about what are we prioritizing? And I think, like Anders is saying, if you invest in your staff and you invest in the people who work for you, they're likely to stay. They're likely to build more long-lasting programming. Mm-hmm. And all of those things can contribute to helping the larger institution.
Anything to add, Anders?
Oh, I think that's absolutely right. And also, let's not forget, when you're talking about an MSI, when you're talking about an art institute, these are institutions that have billion, with a B, $1 billion endowments. So they have resources, and it's about the priorities. Mm.
So, Erica, how do you think that this overall workers movement will, if at all, influence our arts and culture scene here in the city? Because, I mean, that's one of the major things we're known for here in Chicago.
Yeah.
It's so rich.
Yeah. A lot of it remains to be seen. But I heard a really interesting comment from a labor expert. He said, you know, no one wants to see the scene here get weaker. So, you know, donors, patrons, city leaders, they may see this wave and want to step up and support just mm-hmm. to make sure the workers are getting what they need. And they may see, wow, institutions are responding to these workers. We want to support these institutions because they take care of uh-huh. the workers.
Yeah. So, you know, as we wrap here for the folks just tuning in, Chicago museum workers are unionizing. They want better pay, better benefits, more respect. What happens next, Erica, in this movement?
It remains to be seen.
Yeah.
I mean, for what we've heard from labor experts is that they don't expect this wave to slow down. They mm-hmm. expect more workers to continue unionizing. And it's an unprecedented moment. So we're all waiting to see what happens.
Yeah. And you said what the Botanic Garden is, they're writing up paperwork now.
Yeah. They're currently working with management to determine the best way to unionize right yeah. now.
All right. We'll leave it there. Erica Thompson's is Chicago Sun-Times arts and culture reporter. Lilias Meyer works at the Adler Planetarium. And Anders Lindahl is director of public affairs with AFSCME Council 31. Thank you all so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
This WBEZ podcast is supported by the Crown Family School of Social Work Policy and Practice at the University of Chicago. The master's program in social work, social policy, and social administration prepares professionals to address today's most pressing challenges and offers flexible options with part-time and evening classes to support busy adults balancing complex schedules. Inspire change, shape the future at crownschool.uchicago.edu/social work. WBEZ's Nonprofit Spotlight is supported by UChicago Medicine, providing expert primary and urgent care with locations throughout Chicagoland. Their walk-in urgent care locations offer a variety of services for adults and kids 7 days a week. No appointment needed. And for the visits that can wait a day or two, flexible hours and online scheduling make it possible to find a primary care provider partner. Learn more at uchicagomedicine.org.
Now it's time to get into the top local stories of the day. At the table to help me break them down, Claire Lane, WBEZ Morning Edition anchor, and Cindy Hernandez and Mitchell Armentrout, who are reporters for the Chicago Sun-Times. Claire started with some CTA news. A lot more buses are about to be on the roads.
Yes, bus frequency on a few lines. This has been in the works for a while, since March of this year, across 20 lines in total. This is to improve efficiency and frequency on what the CTA is calling some of its most relied upon bus routes. So more frequent bus service across four major routes starting next week. CTA is ensuring that buses will arrive 10 minutes, every 10 minutes, or even sooner than that.
Wow.
Between 6 a.m. and 9 p.m. on weekdays, and then between 9 and 9 on weekends. So the four that are in the mix coming up will be the Ashland bus, the Roosevelt bus, the North Avenue bus, and the Lawrence bus. So pretty big, big arteries in and around Chicago.
Yeah, I know everyone listening was like, is my bus going to be one of those 20 key routes? You know, because one of the main gripes, I think, since the pandemic, which we've talked about so much on this program, slower buses, less frequent, of course, the ghost buses that just don't show up at all. So news like this seems like a big deal.
Yeah, it's a big deal. I mean, wait times, lengthy wait times have been a problem, especially, you know, on trains and buses. People sometimes complaining from O'Hare, they're waiting 20 minutes for a train at certain points in time. And more frequent holiday service has been a problem because is people work on holidays
in this city.
So riders also will see more full-length trips being provided, fewer buses essentially just turning back before reaching the terminal, which has been a problem. So this is the 21st is when this is going to kick in.
Okay, wonderful. Now, Mitch, in other news, we have been following the tragic death of Hollywood legend Rob Reiner. It turns out, though, that Illinois Governor J.B. Pritzker, he actually saw him recently.
Yeah, it actually just happens about 3 days before the Reiners were found dead in L.A. J.B. Pritzker had actually headlined a political fundraiser with the Democratic National Committee that had been co-hosted by Rob Reiner. So, yeah, just obviously the Reiners, longtime supporters of a lot of different liberal causes, big time donors to Democratic politicians, you know. And J.B. Pritzker basically said, you know, these are folks that he had known for years, you know, not particularly close friends, you know, but certainly longtime associates. So, yeah, it kind of really hit home for him pretty hard.
Absolutely. Well, I don't know if you saw this, but President Trump also commented on Reiner's death. It was a pretty wild social media post attacking not just Reiner, but his wife, Michelle. Did Pritzker have anything to say about that?
Yeah, the governor was, he's kind of a, there was a lot of folks who thought this statement from the president was out of line.
Yeah, my Facebook feed was just out of control with people just saying, this is insane. Like, why would you say things like this?
Insensitive, to say the least.
Insensitive. And after his death? Really?
Right. Yeah. So Trump basically suggested that, I don't know if it's supposed to be a joke or what. It came off very strange, suggesting that the Reiners had been killed by something called Trump derangement syndrome, which is this sort of buzz phrase that the right has kind of glommed onto as a way of, you know, that's how they describe liberal politicians who are so upset with Trump policies that they lose their minds.
So centering himself in an announcement about someone else's passing.
Not mentioning any details of the homicide investigation or really any of the sensitivity that comes with that. And yeah, it, you know, Governor Pritzker, obviously a long, you know, he's will not miss any opportunity to criticize the president, but seemed particularly offended by just a pretty dismissive way to talk about what I think anyone could agree is a tragedy.
Yeah. Back in Chicago, particularly city council, this budget battle is continuing in a series of meetings happening this week. And the latest here is, you know, alders are giving up on a very key part of their proposed alternative budget that really would have countered the mayor's corporate tax
idea or corporate head tax, Cindy. Tell us the details there.
So the aldermen are saying that they're going to propose this alternative spending plan that, that will avoid the corporate head tax included in Mayor Johnson's proposal. And in their alternative plan, they had proposed a garbage fee hike, but now they're coming out saying that they will get rid of that.
Yeah, that's huge. They're dropping the garbage fee.
Yeah, yeah.
That's one thing that Mayor Johnson had kind of, that's one of these people fees that, you know, these are fees that are regressive in a lot of ways because all homeowners have to pay that regardless of how big their home is. And yeah, that's really something that he's kind of zeroed in on the last few days, it seems like.
Yeah. Well, so what do you think it is that forced the alder's hand here to really say, okay, fine, we'll give that up?
Because they're afraid that the mayor is going to veto their budget plan. So they are kind of doing what they have to do at this point to avoid that from happening. The alderman and both the mayor are saying that they want to avoid a city government shutdown. So they just need to kind of move this forward.
Yeah, and the clock is ticking, folks, on this budget deadline. They have until December 31st. I think they're trying to do this before the holidays. Good luck. We, though, will have Mayor Johnson right here in studio on In the Loop. He'll be here this Thursday answering your questions and mine about the budget, the city, and much more. So remember to tune in for Ask the Mayor this Thursday at 9 o'clock. This leads me to some sad news in the academic world here. We've got staff at DePaul University pretty upset, Claire.
Yeah, officials at DePaul say more than 100 full-time and part-time staff have been laid off. So leaders say staff who lost their jobs will receive some kind of severance pay. Usually that's dictated by, you know, how long they've been there, what their status is. But the news is coming weeks after DePaul's president, this is Rob Manuel, revealed a hefty budget shortfall, not getting the amount of money that they had been getting previously. Mm-hmm. Manuel also saying the university is spending more on financial aid and that the number of international students has dropped following federal policy changes, which I think we're seeing across the country. International students often pay a tuition premium and subsidized spots for local students. So that's playing into the mix here. The Trump administration has suspended, as we know, student visa interviews and revoked existing student visas without warning for many international students.
Just another blow there for higher ed.
And there will be trickle down from this, certainly.
Absolutely.
I mean, we saw cutbacks at Columbia College, too. I mean, they barely have a functioning staff at this point, full-time people. So colleges in Chicago, not once what they were.
Yeah. And just a note, DePaul is a financial supporter of WBEZ. Any other stories you're watching, Claire?
Well, do you like hot dogs?
I like hot dogs.
Do you like Italian beefs?
I like Italian beefs.
Well, Portillo's is opening a new location on Michigan Avenue, which is...
I was like, what is she getting to?
I'm opening my own shop. No, I'm just kidding. But they, you know, Portillo's is very heavy in the suburbs. This is only going to be their, I believe, their second city location. It's going to be 300 North Michigan Avenue, just south of the Chicago River. And this was obtained, we should note, just by records that Block Club had obtained. A timeline has not been reported yet of when this will open.
But we've got a Portillo's tracker on the website.
Yeah, yeah, I carry one with me. But this, you know, it should be, you know, well, potentially by next year, 2026. Cool. And I should correct myself. It's the fourth location in city limits. It's the second in the downtown area.
Gotcha, gotcha. Are you excited, Mitch? Cindy?
I am. Excited.
It's not a bad dog.
No. I mean, I don't think it's the most iconic Chicago dog. I think that gets a little bit overblown.
Wow.
Not to get too controversial, but I mean, who's going to say no to a Portillo's dog?
Well,
on
it's
Michigan
a tourist
Ave?
Attraction, you know, that has all the kitschy sort of decor inside and people stand in line. So, again, bringing people downtown and money downtown is a good thing.
Well, you know, our senior producer, Meha, is always about, you know, what's most important. She says it'll be easier now to get that delivered to the pier.
That's
where we are. All right. Mitch, Governor Pritzker, let's pivot back to our governor here. He recently signed the state's right to die legislation into law. That was on Friday. Yesterday, he had a little bit more to say about it. Sure.
Right. Governor Pritzker, so he signed this legislation back on Friday. You know, it's a very sensitive issue, obviously. We're talking about giving folks an option to end their lives if they have a terminal illness. So it didn't really, there was no big press conference or anything. You know, there's a lot of emotions behind this issue. You've got religious leaders, including Cardinal Blaise Cupich, who's vehemently against this legislation. Illinois will be the 12th state to allow this when it goes into effect next September. But also disability rights advocates who basically said that this could create pressure, even if it's subtle, for folks with disabilities to, you know, choose to end their lives rather than, you know, continue fighting. Just, you know, if that pressure might be coming from family members or relatives or someone else. But, you know, there was obviously this is a measure that passed the Illinois General Assembly by narrow margins. Mm-hmm. And basically what the governor said was he could have gone either way on this. But what pushed him
over
the edge.
Which is interesting, right?
Right, for him to acknowledge that, you know, this really.
Like, I was still on the fence right before I signed it.
Yeah.
It was what that felt like to me.
It's not a small issue to be undecided about, obviously. But yeah, he said basically that the stories that he heard from folks who have gone through this, either themselves with, you know, we're talking about folks who have a diagnosis from two doctors that they have 6 months or less to live.
Right. So terminally ill patients only.
Correct. Yeah. And the governor was pretty specific in that he doesn't want to see this broadened beyond that, you know, for this to become, you know, an option for folks who don't have that tight of a timeline. Mm-hmm. But yeah, hearing those personal stories, he says, is what really sort of made him decide that this was the right option for folks to have that if they get to that point,
yeah.
Which, you know, I think it's something that a lot of us have dealt with, either in our own families.
Oh, yeah. A lot of people felt strongly. I mean, when we covered it right before he signed, you know, posting our segment on social media, hundreds of comments underneath of people, you know, feeling either way.
Right.
Either way, and strongly, like whatever side you were on, you felt very strongly about that side, that position.
Right. I mean, this is as sensitive a topic almost as, you know, abortion rights, which is another issue that comes
Correct.
Up a lot in Illinois. And yeah, this is something that folks generally aren't going to change their minds about.
Right.
So interesting to hear the governor kind of trying to figure out that balance.
Cindy, a Chicago police detective is accused of planning a hit on a female detective. What?
Yeah. So a female police detective has filed a lawsuit against fellow detective Marco Torres for allegedly ordering a hit on her. In the lawsuit, it says that Detective Torres texted another police officer asking for the female detective, who is also his ex-girlfriend, home address. Mm. And he allegedly had plans to pay a gang member a grand to, quote unquote, get rid of this woman.
A grand?
A grand, yeah.
So $1,000.
$1,000, yeah.
Okay.
Who he was also previously convicted of assaulting during their abusive relationship.
So what did they do to protect her? I mean, so CPD found out because of these texts? Is that what happened?
Yeah. So the woman and her lawyer said that she reported his threats to the department and asked the city for the text and for protection. But in the lawsuit, they claim that the city ignored her request and officials refused to notify the woman that Detective Torres had talked to a gang member about killing her.
Jeez.
Yeah, this just kind of gets back to the code of silence that we've been hearing about in Chicago police for generations.
Ooh, all right, folks, in lighter news, today is Jane Austen's 250th birthday.
Wow.
Did you know?
I did not know. I did not have that on my calendar.
Well, the Chicago area's got plenty of events honoring the beloved British author this week. So, folks, if you're interested, you should check out your local bookstore or library for film screenings, as well as some trivia events. Now, we had WBEZ's Lauren Frost actually go to an actual Regency ball in Glen Ellyn, and it was honoring Jane Austen. So if you want to see pictures of that, which are really beautiful, go to wbez.org. Do we have Jane Austen fans in the house?
You know, I remember, I believe I read Emma back in high school,
okay.
Kind of probably before I could appreciate that. So I, you know, now as a writer, I'm thrilled and happy for her birthday. And this will inspire me to pick up another one.
Yeah, how about it? WBEZ's Claire Lane and Cindy Hernandez and Mitchell Armantrout from the Sun-Times.
This episode of the In the Loop podcast was produced by me, Maha Ahmed, and edited by Ethan Schwab. Sasha Ann Simons is our host. For more in-depth coverage of news and culture in Chicago, be sure to subscribe to this podcast. For a full archive of the show, head over to wbez.org/intheloop. Thanks for listening.
I love how WBEZ shows different sides of the story. I never feel like it's too polarized, and I think the reporters do an excellent job of trying to get the full story, trying to show different other sides. I'm often, when I'm listening to public radio, think in my mind, well, what about X? Or like, I have another question. Or like, have they thought about X? And most of the time, WBEZ thinks about all of it, which I really appreciate.